Trump crosses the border, McCain crosses a threshold, and did Paul LePage cross a line? We'll talk about that on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The Trump campaign hinted for days that its position on immigration was softening. That's not what we heard in Phoenix.
He made the effort to go to Mexico City to meet with the Mexican president and then went right to Phoenix and made that stem winder of a speech going back over every xenophobic, bigoted stance that he's taken throughout the campaign.
The first debate is just weeks away. Often the debates are only remembered for their gotchas and gaffes.
It's kind of too bad. The debates could actually reveal so much more about who's aspiring for the White House than they actually do. What we see is an interview. The core of a debate is an argument, and you never really see argument in these programs.
Plus, do you have a favorite political moment? John Dickerson has plenty.
Tom Eagleton, senator from Missouri. He was only the nominee for 18 days, ultimately kicked from the ticket because he hadn't been straight with McGovern about electroshock treatments he'd had for his depression.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 144 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. With less than 9 weeks to go before the election, is it possible that voters are still not sure what Donald Trump's position on immigration is? For several days, we've heard speculation about a softening. And then Trump held a restrained joint appearance in Mexico with President Enrique Peña Nieto. But just hours later, Trump gave a speech in Phoenix that pushed all the red-hot buttons. He started off with something that might have sounded a bit surprising.
We also discussed the great contributions of Mexican-American citizens to our two countries, my love for the people of Mexico, and the leadership and friendship that we have between Mexico and the United States.
But that didn't last long.
President Obama and Hillary Clinton have engaged in gross dereliction of duty by surrendering the safety of the American people to open borders. And you know it better than anybody right here in Arizona. You know it. President Obama and Hillary Clinton support sanctuary cities. They support catch and release on the border. They support visa overstays. They support the release of dangerous criminals from detention. And they support unconstitutional executive amnesty. Hillary Clinton has pledged amnesty in her first 100 days, and her plan will provide Obamacare, Social Security, and Medicare for illegal immigrants, breaking the federal budget. There are at least 2 million, think of it, criminal aliens now inside of our country. 2 million people, criminal aliens. We will begin moving them out day one, as soon as I take office, day one. Day one, my first hour in office, those people are gone.
So much for that softening. As Trump did his thing in Phoenix, Hillary Clinton went after him in a speech in Reno, Nevada.
Everywhere I go, people tell me how concerned they are by the divisive rhetoric coming from my opponent in this election. And I understand that concern because it's like nothing we've heard before from a nominee for president of the United States from one of our two major parties. From the start, Donald Trump has built his campaign on prejudice and paranoia. He is taking hate groups mainstream and helping a radical fringe take over the Republican Party. His disregard for the values that make our country great is profoundly dangerous.
So where are we now? By some accounts, the race has narrowed. An NBC News poll among registered voters has Clinton ahead 48% to 42%. A CNN poll among likely voters had it even closer. Trump up by 2, 45% to 43%. Clinton's lead in the all-important key battleground states, which is where the race will be decided, remains constant, but it's closer than it was a month ago. All of which suggests that this is the perfect time for you to make your prediction on what you think will be the final Electoral College tally. Send your predictions to contest@krpoliticaljunkie.com. The deadline is September 26th. One Republican who has often found himself in hot water over things he says, but who is not running for president, is Paul LePage, the governor of Maine. Long accused of erratic behavior, LePage recently said that the overwhelming majority of heroin dealers in Maine were Black and Hispanic. And then he left a voice message on a Democratic state lawmaker's phone that was filled with obscenities and threats, a recording I will not play on this program. The governor then suggested that because of the backlash, he might step down. But he seemed to change his mind hours later. LePage will be term limited in 2018 and thus cannot run again. Not every political observer in the state is convinced he will be in office that long. Phyllis Schlafly also knew controversy. A fierce opponent of communism, gay rights, and abortion, she had been involved in conservative causes since the 1950s. In 1964, she wrote the best-selling book, A Choice, Not an Echo, in support of Republican presidential candidate Barry Goldwater. In the 1970s, she spearheaded a right-wing movement that helped derail the Equal Rights Amendment. Here she is in an interview on something called Freedom Maine Radio several years back.
Now, the feminists were always connected with the communist view, because the feminism is against marriage. You know, the one conservative professor at Harvard, whose name is Mansfield, wrote a very fine book called Manliness, and he identified the feminist movement as anti-men, anti-marriage, anti-masculine, anti-motherhood, and anti-morality. And that's all very true.
She forgot anti-M. Phyllis Schlafly died Monday at the age of 92. And finally, we're excited to share that WJSU in Jackson, Mississippi, is the newest station to carry the Political Junkie. In honor of that courageous decision, our trivia question this week is Magnolia State-related. What two Mississippi senators served together the longest in state history? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to our last trivia questions later in the show, so stay tuned.
Mississippi Queen!
The last time we had Neil Conan on the Political Junkie, it was right after the two presidential conventions. Hillary Clinton, her party more united than the GOP, had opened up a bit of a lead over Donald Trump. For his part, Trump was picking a fight with Paul Ryan, John McCain, and a Muslim family whose son, a U.S. soldier, was killed in Iraq. There's been no shortage of headlines for Trump in the past month, most notably his fiery speech on immigration last week in Arizona. Clinton was in the news, too. Lingering questions about more emails to be released and questions about the Clinton Foundation and alleged conflicts of interest. The two continue to have high unfavorables and are running close together in most of the polls. So that's a perfect time to bring back Neil Conan to the Political Junkie. Neil, welcome back.
Welcome back, Ken.
What do you think the race stands right now?
I think it is tightening. There's no question about that. I think Clinton's got a clear lead. Some polls are better for her, some are worse. Some show her in the high single digits. Some show it's pretty close, even Trump ahead in some states.
Do we agree that national polls at this point are not the ones we should be focusing on? We should be looking at the key battleground state polls?
Absolutely. And the key battleground states have expanded a little bit. There's just a poll out this week that shows Arizona neck and neck. Now, that's probably anomalous, but, you know, that could be in play. Georgia could be in play. North Carolina, certainly. So, yeah, absolutely. Look at the state polls much more than the national polls.
And I think we both agree that if Donald Trump is going to win, I mean, one, he has to pick apart some of those battleground states that Obama has won the last two times, but he can't afford to lose any Romney states like Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina, even Texas, which I can't believe is in play, is in single digits, according to some polls. So
I can't believe Texas is in play, but I think the key state for him is Florida. If he can't win Florida, it's really hard for me to figure out how he wins at that point.
Ohio, too, right?
Well, Florida's got more electoral votes than Ohio does. And it's just you look at the map and you do that math, and it's really hard for him without Florida.
What do you make? I'm sure you saw the same thing we saw here in the East, that for days we were talking about, or people were talking about, a possible softening of Donald Trump's position on immigration. Everybody, Kellyanne Conway and all his campaign staffers were giving hints that he was going to, you know, be more moderate and maybe win more establishment Republican votes. And then comes along this speech in Phoenix that was hardly moderating.
Yeah, and the baffling thing was that he made the effort to go to Mexico City to meet with the Mexican president and looked, you know, it's a pretty low bar for Donald Trump, but looked something like a president, and then went right to Phoenix and made that, you know, a stem winder of a speech, going back over every xenophobic, bigoted stance that he's taken throughout the campaign. Unbelievable to me.
Didn't you love that Donald Trump starts his speech by talking about how much he loves the Mexican president and the Mexican people?
Absolutely. And then apparently unwilling to bring up the subject of building a wall in Mexico will pay for it in the meeting with the Mexican president. He goes right back to it in Phoenix.
On the one hand, nothing seems to hurt him. And on the other hand, he's just doing so many things wrong that is impeding his chances.
Well, one thing that might begin to hurt him a little bit is this story that's sort of echoed this past couple of weeks, and that's the $25,000 campaign donation to Pam Bondi, the Attorney General of Florida, that arrived 4 days after she mysteriously decided not to join the lawsuit against Trump University. Suspicious timing, at the very least. That could set him back a little bit. But the path to victory, you know, we were talking about Ohio and Florida just a minute ago. Don't you think that his feud with John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, is going to come back to bite him? You need troops on the ground if you're going to win a close state like Ohio. And are those Kasich supporters going to come out and work for Donald Trump? I don't think so. Do you?
Well, I agree with you. I think the fact that John Kasich has not lifted a finger, the fact that he has not didn't go to the convention, the fact that, and the convention was in his own state.
In his own state, yes.
The fact that he refuses to endorse, and we know the history of, not so much that no Republican has won without Ohio, but it has picked the winner since Nixon beat Kennedy in Ohio in 1960. Every person who was elected president won Ohio. I mean, it picks the winners, and you know, it's not a state he can afford to lose, right?
I don't think so. I don't think he can afford to lose that. He can't afford to lose Pennsylvania, and as I said, keep your eye on Florida.
Are there surprises you see? You mentioned North Carolina. My goodness. I mean, that was once upon a time. Well, not even once upon a time. Not that long ago that the Republicans seemed to be on the ascendancy there. And yet.
Well, Obama did carry it in 08, and it was, very close in 12.
It was closer in 8. It was much closer in 8 than it was in 12. But also you have this very conservative legislature that is putting up these voter ID roadblocks that African Americans and other minorities are saying is racially bigoted. And you have this bathroom gender bill that is as royal politics, and it probably could bring down the governor, which never happens in North Carolina.
And I think what's happened is that once the Republicans got control and started passing those measures that you were talking about, I think there's been a bit of a recoil in North Carolina against that. And that's why the governor's in trouble. That's why Senator Barr might be in trouble.
And that would be something, too. I mean, basically, the Barr's Democratic opponent is a former state director of the ACLU. And if you had told me that the former director of the state ACLU would win a Senate seat in North Carolina, I would have said, I don't think that's possible. The next big event, of course, is in a couple of weeks, the debates. What are you looking for? And, who could predict what's going to happen?
Who could predict what's going to happen? You know, the odd thing is that the bar for Hillary Clinton is set very high, and the bar for Donald Trump is set very low. Everybody says she's a much better debater. So we have to be careful of judging them on different scales. The media and the voters have to look at these two people as equivalent, not just, Trump got through it without really falling on his face. Look at their policies. Look how they handle themselves. You know, is he going to start turning into something more presidential, or is he going to do a Rodrigo Duterte and just call people names?
Well, that's a good point. First of all, I was thinking of the Gore-Bush debates in 2000 when everybody said, mm-hmm. Gore is going to wipe the floor with Bush because Bush is just folksy and not that smart. And because Bush didn't make any mistakes and Al Gore had his famous size, the
eye rolling, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I always thought size wasn't important. But anyway, that's a bit, but we'll probably take that out of the show. But you're absolutely right. I think you don't have to add points, give... You don't have to judge them on separate stages and separate planes. You have to look at what they say and weigh their principles and positions and be fair about it.
And it's interesting that Trump is sort of emphasizing that he's not, engaging in mock debates, not really preparing for this. This is a guy who twice in this campaign has made it clear that he does not know what the nuclear triad is, which is sort of, presidential duties 101. If he's not going to study, he could come off looking, having problems. Hillary Clinton, clearly her problem is not lack of study.
The last I saw, who knows if this is accurate or not, but the last I saw, Trump has been meeting with Rudy Giuliani, Laura Ingraham, and Roger Ailes, and they're trying to come up with some gotcha moments.
Just stop there for a second. Roger Ailes, if the Clinton campaign had a serial sexual molester as one of their chief advisors, what would the headlines be like?
What do you also make of, they hold a list of the moderators. You have, you had Lester Holt, you had Martha Raddatz, Anderson Cooper, Chris Wallace. What do you think of the moderators? I thought it was a good choice, good choices.
I thought it was a good choice. I wish a Hispanic had been somehow gotten onto the list. I think that would have, there's certainly a lot of tensions within that community particularly with Donald Trump. Maybe that's why they decided not to do it, that it would be too provocative. But it's past time for them to have their first.
Unlikely at this point that you're going to see Gary Johnson or certainly Jill Stein. No third party candidates included in the debates.
Not unless they can get to 15% in the polls. And you'd figure if it was, 13 or 12, maybe they give him the benefit of the doubt. But because at that point, people would be screaming. But right now, I don't think he's in double digits. So and Jill Stein is not above 3%, I don't think.
There's always these talks about a possible October surprise, a possible dumping of emails that could be critical.
Well, yeah, those emails I don't think are going to be, the FBI looked at those emails. They were part of their investigation. So I don't think we should expect any bombshells in there.
Well, here's a bombshell. I understand you will not be on the show next month because you're going to be in Africa.
Actually, I'm going to be running for vice president with Evan McMullen. Yes, Gretel and I are going on a trip to Southern Africa, and I'm really looking forward to it, though I hate to miss that critical month of this election.
Are you going to be in Eastern Africa?
Southern Africa, in Zimbabwe, near Victoria Falls.
Oh, because I was going to say you can't have Kenya without Ken. I just thought I'd point that out.
Just so you put that in there.
Okay, so since you're not going to be with us for the pre-election show, next month's show, okay, this is the last chance I get to talk to you before November 8th. Tell me, what do you see? What do you see? Tell me what you see. Tell me.
I think Secretary Clinton will win this handily in the Electoral College with a plurality of 3 or 4, maybe 6 points. The ground game, I think, in the end is going to mean a lot. She has one. He doesn't. People tell you it's good for 3, maybe 4 points, and that's going to be the difference.
What about the Senate?
Senate, I think there's a chance the Democrats get to 50-50, I think.
Because I was going to say, I mean, it looked like Mark Kirk and Ron Johnson of Illinois and Wisconsin right now look like they're going to go down to defeat. There are other Republicans who seem to be teetering.
You know, it could come down to Pennsylvania and Ohio. Right now, Ohio looks pretty good for Senator Portman. There's a very inexperienced Democrat running in Pennsylvania, but, you know, there could be such a Clinton wave there that could cost them that seat.
And New Hampshire's even as well.
Yeah, New Hampshire's as well. I think New Hampshire's is lost.
Neil Conan is a news analyst with Hawaii Public Radio. He's also the former host of Talk of the Nation. And he appears on The Political Junkie, the first show of every month, except not for next month. Neil, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Okay, Ken. Good to talk to you.
Have a safe trip.
Thanks.
One of the most fascinating things to watch in this most fascinating political year has been the relationship, or whatever you want to call it, between Donald Trump and John McCain. It started, I guess, after this exchange between Trump and Republican pollster Frank Luntz in July of last year.
And I said, somebody should run against John McCain, who has been, you know, in my opinion, not so hot. And I supported him. I supported him for president. I raised $1 million for him. It's a lot of money. I supported him. He lost. He let us down. But, you know, he lost. So I never liked him as much after that, because I don't like losers. But Frank, let me get to it. He hit me. He's not a war hero.
He's a war hero.
He's a war hero.
5.5 years.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
Do you agree with that?
He's a war hero because he was captured, okay?
It's been a rough ride ever since. McCain sounding pained every time he's asked if he supports his party's nominee. Trump initially refusing to endorse McCain because, he said, McCain let down the war veterans. It was only after a huge blowback from the party when Trump broke down and said, yes, I will endorse McCain. Although he read it from a statement that seemed to have been written by somebody else. Dan Nowicki is the national political reporter with the Arizona Republic and has been watching this dance for the better part of a year. Dan, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Yeah, hey, thanks, Ken, for having me on.
McCain has had some rocky moments with conservatives. I mean, that's been going on for a long time. I mean, and he had a tough primary 6 years ago, but I don't remember him feuding with the presidential nominee of his own party before.
Yeah, no, I think that's really unprecedented. And you saw it not only from McCain, but also Mitt Romney kind of going after this year's nominee. So McCain's not alone, but he is alone maybe in the sense that he is on the ballot in some of these other figures are not. Donald Trump's also feuding with Senator Jeff Flake, who is, you know, Arizona's other Republican senator, but Flake's not on the ballot and McCain is. So McCain has to be a lot more careful.
Although the difference is Flake said he would not endorse and McCain ostensibly has endorsed.
Right. No, that's exactly true. And if the roles were reversed, I'm sure Senator Flake would say he would still not endorse him, but who knows what would happen if this was an election year for him as well. But definitely, Senator McCain is very frustrated by the situation he's in. It's gotten a little bit better for him now that he's cleared Arizona's primary. He had a kind of a aggressive but underfunded Tea Party candidate running against him, and he managed to get through that all right without kicking the Trump's hornet's nest. So I know a lot of people were kind of asking, well, is this the time where McCain's really going to open up on Trump? And I don't really think so, just given the way that the general election is unfolding. It's still a really close race, and I don't think McCain wants to go out of his way to alienate any Republicans this year.
I thought it was interesting when Donald Trump returned from Mexico and gave that immigration speech in Phoenix. Prior to Trump's speech, Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama, was warming up the crowd. And he congratulated McCain on winning the primary, and he got booed.
Right, yeah, and that's it happened twice, actually. Another speaker also congratulated McCain, and he got booed as well. And I guess that is a crowd that's going to be very anti-McCain. The question is, are those people going to vote for Ann Kirkpatrick, the Democratic congresswoman, or are they going to hold their nose and vote for McCain in November? Probably some of them will stay home or leave that office blank, maybe, because they really don't like McCain to such a degree that I can't see them voting under any circumstances. But probably a lot of people who are maybe tired of McCain on the Republican side would have liked to have had an alternative. I think they probably will put the clothespin on their nose when they go into the ballot box and probably vote for him.
How many times do you think McCain is asked to respond to something that Trump said or did?
I know his opponent, Ann Kirkpatrick's campaign, it keeps a running tally, and I think they're up to around 60 times where they've had McCain as endorsed to some degree Trump as the nominee. And I know that McCain has said at news conferences, I'm not answering that question anymore. If I change my position, I'll let you know. But apparently it still comes out from time to time.
Do you have a sense of what ways, if any, does the Trump candidacy, the Trump nomination for president, how does it affect John McCain's chances for another term?
I think the way that the Democrats have linked McCain to Trump could hurt McCain. McCain obviously sees himself as separate and tries to distance himself on certain issues from Trump, particularly national security. One big issue is the issue that Trump took aim at McCain for last year, which he called him very weak on immigration. And there is a big difference between McCain, who has a history of championing immigration reform, and Trump, who takes the opposite tack of building the wall and the deportation. So certainly the Democrats, who are trying to play for the Latino electorate in Arizona, want to make McCain answer for those Trump policies. And McCain wants to let them know that, hey, I'm for immigration reform. McCain is doing a little bit of a dance there, because he is also trying to stress the I'm for the secure border too, but we also have to take care of the immigrants who are in the country already.
I think the most striking thing that I saw in the primaries, that after all was said and done, and even though his opponents, as you say, were underfinanced, McCain only got 51% of the total primary vote.
And the problem with McCain is, in Arizona, he's got just about 100% name ID, so it's really hard to change his numbers. You either know him and you like him, or you know him and you hate him. So it's really hard to move the needle at all. So that's why they're mostly focusing on making his rivals unacceptable alternatives to him.
You're a political reporter, so you probably don't have money. But if you had money, what candidate would you put it on?
Well, I think it's kind of hard to bet against McCain. It's still a Republican advantage state, and he definitely is taking it seriously. The analysts that I've talked to say McCain seems to be doing everything he needs to do. It's a tough environment for sure, and he's got a lot of challenges. And it wouldn't be unheard of if he does get beat. But it's kind of one of those issues where McCain's running against himself. If his time is up and the voters just get sick of him, there's probably not much he could do about it, and not much Ann Kirkpatrick can do about it either. It's really a referendum on McCain, I think, at that point.
And Donald Trump in the state, that Arizona looks like one of the states that is questionable about where it might go in November.
Right, yeah. In fact, the Arizona Republic just commissioned a poll that just came out, and it showed Hillary Clinton with a point or so lead on Trump here in Arizona. And so it's definitely a toss-up, something no one saw coming. Obviously, Mitt Romney, I think, won the state by 8 or 9 points in 2012. And for it to be so close makes you kind of scratch your head a little bit about what's going on with Arizona. There's been talk for years that Arizona is a red state that's gradually getting purple, and that's probably true, but it looks like Trump has accelerated that process a little bit, at least this year.
Dan Nowicki is a national political reporter for the Arizona Republic. You can follow him on Twitter at Dan Nowicki, Nowicki. Dan, thanks a lot for being on the program.
Hey, thanks, Ken. I appreciate it.
Come on.
As I mentioned earlier in the program, the moderators for the presidential debates were named last week, one each from NBC, CNN, ABC, Fox, and CBS. The first debate is just a couple of weeks away, September 26th at Hofstra University on Long Island in New York. Many people can't wait for the fireworks to begin. Others are dreading the likelihood of a circus-like atmosphere. But John Donvan has a different perspective. He's a correspondent for ABC News, but also a debate moderator for something called Intelligence Squared. John, welcome to the Political Junkie.
It is a pleasure to be on the Junkie. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Well, you know, everybody I've talked to, they say they can't wait for the food fight to begin. But this is hardly what they envisioned when they created these televised debates between Nixon and Kennedy in 1960.
Yeah, interestingly enough, I recently had a conversation with Newton Minow, who was the guy who put the debates together in the first place. And he was a real believer in the public having an appetite to really dig into substance and to hear the candidates have to justify their points of view. And he's actually got a seat on the Presidential Debate Commission and is highly respected there. That said, the Kennedy-Nixon debate was a different kind of thing from what we see nowadays. And I know people get a lot of entertainment value out of seeing two people enter into the boxing ring and slug at each other in a sort of shallow, superficial, zinger-filled way. My own view is that it's kind of too bad. The debates could be so much more and could actually reveal so much more about who's aspiring for the White House than they actually do.
You know, next week on this program, we're doing a special broadcast about great moments in debate history. And when people think of debate history, they always think of, you know, the gaffes and the one-liners. You're no Jack Kennedy. I will not make an age an issue. There's no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe. But is that the wrong way to be judging these debates?
I totally think so. And I have to admit, I've done that piece every 4 years where you're asked to put together the great debate moments. And I've come to the conclusion that we don't have moments. We might have some great moments, but not great moments of debate or great debating moments. We really don't see a debate when the candidates get up in these forums. What we see is an interview with one candidate followed immediately afterwards by an interview with another candidate, and it goes back and forth. And I suppose that makes sense because the moderators are always journalists. They're always journalists, and nobody questions whether that makes sense or not. And what journalists are used to doing is to interviewing in order to make news. And so the moderator becomes a really critical part of what you see in front of you. But again, because I'm saying what the journalist is really doing is interviewing simultaneously two people, you don't really see a debate. And a debate, by my lights, is when the two candidates interact with each other and argue with each other. The core of a debate is an argument, and you never really see argument in these programs.
Well, who do we blame for what's happened to the debates? Do we blame the moderators? Do we blame the candidates? The need for ratings and on cable TV? Who's at fault?
Yeah, I think those are all real things, and I don't want to sound too esoteric about it because I watch these things and I get a kick out of them. There's very strong entertainment value, and the more that they play to zingers and that kind of thing, you know, probably the more the ratings go up. I mean, certainly, you know, from the first Republican so-called debate, and I always call them so-called debates because they're not really debates, so-called debate last year when Megyn Kelly put the question to Donald Trump, Trump's response is what, number one, made him, but it also is what kept him on television. He was putting on a lot of entertainment value, and yes, it did reveal a little bit about something about Donald, but when Megyn Kelly asks Donald Trump a question about his track record of sexism, that's not a debate. She didn't then go to Marco Rubio and ask him to debate whether Donald Trump is a sexist, nor did she go to Rubio and say to Rubio, well, what about you as a sexist? She was interviewing Donald Trump. She had him, you know, live on a stage, and so she asked him an embarrassing question to get a rise, and so all of that goes. So when you say whose fault is it, I really think it's baked into the format. The candidates don't really want to debate. That's my conclusion, and I've looked into this a bit, and I've spoken with members of the commission. I think the commission really does have, you know, there are serious people on that group, like Olympia Snow and my former colleague Charlie Gibson of ABC News and Bob Schieffer and Newton Minow and Mike McCurry, who really care about, you know, serious discourse. But the problem is that in the end, no matter what anybody says, it's a negotiation with the candidates, what they're willing to do and what they're willing to agree to do. and they're not willing to debate. There have been years in which the rules said that the candidates are forbidden to speak to each other and will only talk to the moderator. Having something like that cooked in means that there's just not going to be a debate. And I think that's because the candidates are scared. They're scared to actually expose themselves to argument. And so they go into this safe format where they can try to game out every possible question and then memorize an answer and a zinger and then do a little pivot halfway through their 2 minutes to where they're just attacking the other candidate's record on something or other. But that's no argument. There's no argument over an important point going on in those things. And so whose fault is it really? I think it's the tradition of the candidates not wanting to actually debate.
You were talking about the kind of questioning that Megyn Kelly asked of Donald Trump in that first debate. What role do you think moderators should have in like, for example, correcting the responses of candidates? Candy Crowley of CNN got heat when she responded to a Mitt Romney answer in 2012. I want to play that piece of that tape.
Want to make sure we get that for the record, because it took the president 14 days before he called the attack in Benghazi an act of terror.
Get the transcript.
He did, in fact, sir. So let me call it an act of terror.
Can you say that a little louder, Candy?
He did call it an act of terror.
Was that her role, do you think?
No. I'm a big Candy Crowley fan. I always have been. I think moderating is hard. It's hard to know where to find the line. I think she crossed it, and here's why. If the candidates were debating with each other, it should not have been the moderator who would fact-check Mitt Romney on the facts. It should have been Barack Obama. He's the one debating, not Candy. And if the thing were set up so that they were really debating, what should have happened is that Romney would have made that comment, and she and the entire audience would have looked to Obama for his response. And if he had prepared, he would have had his facts ready, and he would have responded, and the debate would have continued. You know, part of the problem with Candy doing that then is Candy's a really honest journalist. She was not trying to side with Barack Obama against Mitt Romney. She was trying to side with the truth. But the problem is, by stepping in that way, she opened herself up to the accusation that she was taking sides. And moderators should never be seen taking sides. And moderators should leave it to the debaters to fact-check each other, not be the fact-checker.
Tell me about Intelligence Squared. How do your debates differ from what we see, what we always see in these presidential debates?
Intelligence Squared is a program that's been going on since 2006, where about once a month we put a debate on stage in New York City, or sometimes, you know, this week we're doing one in Washington, D.C. What we do is follow what's called the Oxford-style format. And the Oxford format, it's set up to be an argument where the debaters have to prove something. And the way we do that is we choose what's called a motion or a resolution or a proposition that the two teams of debaters, it can be pairs or triples or individuals, but they're on opposite sides of the statement, and they have to prove that their side is right. For example, you know, something that's current today, we might say that the resolution would be a path to citizenship should be found for undocumented immigrants. That's the resolution. And one side would say, yes, here's why that path should be found, and have to prove the point by presenting logic and ideas, how it would work, why it would work, what's the morality behind it. The other side would have to say, prove the negative. No, that's not correct. Here's what's wrong with that. Here's why there is no moral obligation. Here are the pitfalls. And here are my arguments. Here are my facts. And in that kind of debate, then it's a debate. Then an argument is developing. Both sides are developing arguments. They can go at each other. They can pummel each other in terms of the facts and poke holes in each other's arguments. But there actually needs to be an argument. They actually would need to prove something. And you learn so much more about who a person is and how they think and how good they are at thinking when you see them in that sort of format. And, you know, sometimes I've been asked, well, would the American public tolerate something that, you know, high level? And I find that when we do these debates, that we sell out theaters with these debates, and people come out. Sometimes it's the first time they've ever been to one, saying, I never knew something like that could be so exciting. And I actually changed my mind, in part because they never heard a full argument made before. You know, maybe Hillary Clinton would make the argument for finding a path to citizenship. Well, in a televised debate such as we're going to see, all she's going to get to do is assert it. She's going to assert it that she wants that, and then she's going to pivot and attack Donald Trump. In our kind of debate, she would be on there, and you would start to understand why she thought that, how she thought it would work. That would be an entirely different thing. I mean, that's why Intelligence Squared, we've put up a petition to the Presidential Debate Commission at change.org. It's change.org/fixthedebates, actually proposing that they try out the Oxford-style format that we use, and we've been very pleased with the response. We have about 60,000 signatures already. Some of it based on a little sample we show there, but also we have now a pretty devoted following of people who kind of get the idea that this kind of debate really does work.
I think we both agree, though, that nobody's going to change the rules with only 3 weeks to go. Are we talking about 2020 or in our lifetime?
It's going to have to be sometime else in our lifetime because it's not going to happen this time. But we decided to, you know, once the rules were announced a few weeks back or about a month and a half ago, we decided to keep it up, and the signatures kept coming. So, we'll keep it there and see where it goes next time. But here's the other thing I'll say about that is, in that kind of debate, the moderator's job is to make sure people stay on topic, that they answer the questions, that they actually interact with each other, that they don't try to duck the opponent. Then it's a different role. And then the moderator plays a very important role. But he's not interviewing the debaters, and he's not fact-checking the debaters. He's facilitating a true argument.
What you were just saying a few minutes ago, you mentioned the word logic. I haven't heard that word used in a presidential debate in a long time.
No, and I'm repeating myself now, but it's really been exciting for me to be at these debates. And sometimes I've seen people like bring along a date to one of our debates, dragged along, to be frank, because they think, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to go see an Oxford-style debate. And then they come out. I sometimes videotape them with my phone because I'm so thrilled that they're thrilled, where they talk about how great the thing was and how exciting it was. And then again, sort of the gold standard is, I changed my mind because I'd never heard the argument from the other side before.
John Donvan is an ABC News correspondent and a debate moderator for Intelligence Squared. You can find out more by going to intelligencesquaredus.org. I also want to note that John also has recently written a very well-received book entitled In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. John, thanks so much for being on the program.
It was really, really an honor. I just want to know if I get a prize of any kind.
Yes, 2 weeks in Philadelphia.
Thank you, Ken.
Thanks, John.
Bye-bye.
By the way, coming up next week on The Political Junkie, we'll spend the entire show looking back at great moments in the history of the presidential and vice presidential debates. You won't want to miss it. And that includes you, John Donvan.
What's the greatest threat to our nation today? Is it ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or the gluten-free craze?
ISIS rides around in the U.S. Humvees. We should fund our enemies.
We know you love guns. We heard you loud and clear. Now prove you love them more than everybody else here.
Look, I don't want my guns registered in Washington.
Why should you be the next commander-in-chief?
I'm the only one to separate Siamese twins.
We got a lot of contenders, so please keep it brief.
I will make our country great again.
Could you kindly present some relevant evidence?
We can grow, we can do this.
Why you should be the next White House president?
Our leaders are stupid.
You could be the president.
I'm gonna run hard.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our last two trivia questions. First, before 2016, when was the last time the two major parties both nominated a governor or a former governor for vice president? The answer, 1968. The Democrats selected Maine Senator Ed Muskie, a former governor, and the Republicans picked Spiro Agnew, the governor of Maryland. The randomly selected winner is Sean Walbeck of Bellingham, Washington. Sean wins the coveted Political Junkie button. The earlier question was, who was the last presidential candidate to have led in the polls on Labor Day but lost in November? The answer is Al Gore. He narrowly led George W. Bush around Labor Day in 2000, but ultimately lost the election, even though he won the popular vote. The randomly selected winner in that one is Dylan Lee of Salt Lake City, Utah. And we have a Scuttlebutton puzzle winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. The solution to our last puzzle was Black Lives Matter, and the winner is Liz Dunham of Madison, Wisconsin. As always, check out our website for the latest campaign updates, scuttlebutton puzzles, political columns, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store. Go to krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Sing it proud.
Black lives matter.
Most weeks on this program, we have a This Week in Political History feature, where we celebrate or commemorate a major political event of the past. Our next guest has a new book out filled with plenty of such great political events. John Dickerson is the moderator of Face the Nation, as well as the political director for CBS News. Before that, a correspondent for Time magazine for almost 15 years. What I've always loved about John Dickerson, a political junkie's political junkie, is his enthusiasm and his even-handedness. And it comes through in Whistle Stop, my favorite stories from presidential campaign history. John, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Ken, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you so much. It's an honor.
Well, thank you so much. I there's something you wrote in the introduction that I've always said and I've always felt. You were talking about conversations you've had and stories you've shared over the years, and you wrote this. While you're watching one race, there's usually an echo from the past that gives you a guide about what might happen. And I think that's true almost every time. For example, when I'm in New Hampshire and I go to New Hampshire every 4 years, I think of Ronald Reagan paying for that microphone or Ed Muskie crying in the snow or something like that, or you're at the convention and immediately you see Abe Ribicoff talking about Gestapo tactics, or you see Everett Dirksen pointing his finger at Thomas Dewey. You can't help it, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's fun just on a basic, level, because those moments were moments of high drama. The characters, Everett Dirksen in particular, oh my gosh, what a fun character he is. And that's lots of fun. But then also, it does give you, in moments of swirl in a current campaign, it gives you a little bit of grounding and you can feel like you have a little bit of control over events that seem to be kind of out of control.
Well, something, that's an interesting point, because everybody's talking about, the latest thing about Donald Trump. And of course, if you're not for Donald Trump and you're a Republican or you're a Democrat, you say, oh, this could be the end of the Republican Party. But they said that about Barry Goldwater in 64. And yet the Republicans came back with big gains in Congress in 66 and Nixon won in 68. So, the thing that's going to be the end forever often is not the case.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In fact, you could almost argue that as soon as somebody is, declaring the end of a party or declaring the end of a movement, that's the time to buy that stock. When I covered Wall Street for Time magazine at the beginning of my career, there was one political analyst that I interviewed who said basically any time Time magazine declares a bear market on the cover, that's the time you're about to have a bull market, and vice versa. And I think that's right. The swings in politics are they happen pretty fast. And declaring either party dead is not going to last very long.
Right. Nixon winning 49 states in 72, and then Watergate in 74. That came right after. Yeah. You start your book with a 1980 Republican debate that, in my mind, is always going to be rated as one of the most consequential in party history. It took place in Nashua, New Hampshire, and not long before that, Ronald Reagan had lost the Iowa caucuses to George Bush. Walk us through that New Hampshire debate.
Well, as you point out, he'd lost in Iowa, and here's the guy who would come so close to beating an incumbent president, Ford, in 76. So he's the big hero. Bush comes out of Iowa, has the big mo, as he called it, and then basically wants to finish off Reagan in New Hampshire. They collude to have a man on a one-on-one debate. They both think it's in their self-interest, and they're ready to do it, and it's ready to go. It's going to be sponsored by the Nashua Telegraph, they get into a little back and forth with the Federal Elections Commission about whether the newspaper is giving an in-kind donation. Reagan and Bush got around this by having Reagan pay for the debate, not having it paid for by the National Telegraph. But John Bream, the editor of the paper, nevertheless moderated the debate. Reagan, at the last minute, decided, no, I don't want it to be man-on-man. I want everybody to be there. And so the curtain goes up on our drama at the gymnasium at the high school in Nashua. And there you have Reagan and Bush in their chairs. They'd had a fight all day long about whether to include the other candidates, and Bush didn't want to. He said he was going to stick to the agreement between the two of them. Reagan said they should be included. When everybody goes out on stage, Reagan and Bush have seats, and Baker and Dole and Anderson don't have seats. They're just standing there on the stage.
We can't forget Phil Crane.
Poor Phil Crane. And John Connally was running too, but he wasn't on stage because he thought it was all a big show and he didn't want to be a part of it.
Well, so we have George Bush sitting on, you know, sitting there, and things were basically spiraling away from him. And let me play that classic piece of tape.
Would the sound man please turn Mr. Reagan's mic off for a minute? Is this on? Mr. Green, did you turn that microphone
you
off?
You asked for me if you would. I am paying for this microphone, Mr. Green.
Well, other than the fact that John Breen became John Green, that was an amazing moment for Ronald Reagan.
It really was. No, there were no fact checkers who were going to weigh in there and destroy the moment by pointing out that Reagan had mispronounced John Breen's name, the editor of the Nashua Telegraph. It was an amazing moment, and Craig Shirley, an aide for Reagan, says that they had paid the sound man, since Reagan had written the $3,000 check to pay for the debate, that they had the sound man on the payroll. And that's important because when the Nashua Telegraph editor, John Breen, tries to cut off his microphone, the sound man doesn't listen to the editor because the guy paying his check is Ronald Reagan. And what I, you know, so the reason the moment, I mean, just listening to it there, I get chills because of the drama of it. But Reagan was, his campaign message was essentially, I'll be tougher on the Russians and the bloat of the government than anybody else. And here he was occupying the actual image of that. He was behaving in the way he had promised to on the campaign trail.
I also noticed that you talk about stories that happened or may have happened or happened were embellished. I think in this moment in 1972, when Ed Muskie is standing outside the offices of the Manchester Union leader, I'm going to play a piece of tape. I want you to tell me the story behind it.
By attacking me, by attacking my wife, he has proved himself to be a gutless coward. Maybe I said all I should on that point. But it's fortunate for him, he's not on this platform beside me.
And then he started to talk about, Senator Muskie started to talk about his wife, Jane, and then he stopped.
He stopped, and this is such a great, I mean, the reason I love these stories so much is that in that you have, you know, so much is going on. He's called this press conference. He was a bit of a famous hothead, Muskie was, and so he was railing at the publisher, William Loeb, the Manchester Union leader, who was the one I mentioned earlier, who had helped Reagan against Bush, who called him Moscow Muskie, and we're anyway, he's come to yell at Loeb. But what breaks him up, and the question is how much was he broken up, was really when he referred to his wife. And here you had Jane Muskie, who had sacrificed so much for her husband's campaign and career, as spouses many have. The real reason he was emotionally broken up was that Loeb had run an editorial on the front page of the paper. That was actually a piece that was written by Newsweek magazine, but Muskie felt like, and it was a piece about Jane Muskie, and Muskie felt like running the editorial on the front page was making fun of her. And here's a woman who had, you know, was out there working for his campaign, had sort of was sacrificing, and now she's paying the price and getting attacked. But what got Muskie upset was the reference to his wife. He appeared to cry, and some who were there said, oh, we didn't cry. That was the snow that was falling. Others said, oh, my gosh, he was a river of tears and a total mess. And, of course, his opponents said that he was, unfit for the presidency. He was too emotional in his response. And so it became a big debate about whether he did or didn't cry.
Isn't it funny that after all these decades later, we still don't know if it was tears or snow?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think I went back and watched the videotape. And, I mean, it's definitely clear that he is emotional. But and so if an emotional candidate is one who's unfit for the job, I'm just then okay, he was emotional. But on the question of tears, I think David Broder's account of it, and Broder of course is syndicated and so had a huge influence on the thinking of the country and other political reporters. I mean, he basically said he was, you know, tears were streaming down his face, and I think that doesn't look like it was the case. And so that's why the kind of yes, was it snow or was it not? Is still up for debate.
Well, whether Muskie cried or not, we do know that many Democrats cried after this event later that summer.
And surely I did not expect to stand before you tonight as the Democratic nominee for Vice President of the United States. It is thus with deep humility in the face of the responsibility you've asked me to assume and with profound gratitude to you, the delegates, and of course to Senator McGovern, that I accept your nomination.
Oh my, did that kill the Democrats that year?
Oh man, Tom Eagleton, Senator from Missouri. Again, another one of these stories, you know, I knew about and I read about, and he was only the nominee for 18 days, ultimately kicked from the ticket because he hadn't been straight with McGovern about electroshock treatments he'd had for his depression. What I loved about this story, though, which is, again, there are humans at the center of these campaigns, which we forget, and in retelling these stories, you really remember it. And, I mean, everything from the fact that McGovern's daughter had mental health issues, and so once he found out about Eagleton's, even though Eagleton had not been straight with him, he felt like cutting him off the ticket would be possibly sending a signal to his own daughter. I mean, there were lots of other reasons he didn't knock him off the ticket immediately, and including he said things like, I'm behind Eagleton 1,000%, and once you say that, it's kind of hard to climb back down again, although he ultimately did.
You know, there's a lot of debate. We were talking about these events, and there's a lot of debate going on whether, well, one, the crying in the snow, did it end Muskie's hopes, or whether Eagleton ended McGovern's chances. But I want to play a piece of tape, and you tell me what effect it had on the speaker.
You know something? Not only are we going to New Hampshire, Tom Harkin, we're going to South Carolina and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Dakota and New Mexico. We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House. Yeah!
John Dickerson, what say you?
Oh, I love listening to these again. It's interesting. It's tied a little bit to the Muskie in the Snow. I mean, so Muskie in the Snow is really, for me, a story about expectations. Everybody thought, here's a guy from a neighboring state. He's the towering colossus in the Democratic race. He's going to just wipe everybody off the map in New Hampshire. And he did win, but he didn't win by enough. And then one of his aides said that since he didn't get a big enough margin of victory, that it was a nightmare. And it's just, you know, we now, politicians now learn and now know that you're always supposed to set expectations very low. So even if you win by a point, it's seen as a great national movement. So in the case with Dean, that's what had happened in Iowa, is that his campaign manager, Joe Trippi, had about a year ago earlier written a memo and said, look, if we don't come in first or second in Iowa, we're sunk because we won't be able to build up enough kind of momentum to carry on with the rest of the campaign. In part because we'd have to compete in South Carolina against John Edwards, who was born there, came from a neighboring state. So we need real national momentum to kind of carry on the campaign. Well, he got it. He was seen as the Democratic nominee. He was on the cover of the news magazines. Al Gore and Bill Bradley had endorsed him. And so his expectations were sky high. And then he came in third in Iowa, and that killed him. He had 18%. I mean, he wasn't even close. And that was what killed him as a campaign, and then he came out and gave that scream speech, which to me was all about trying to speak to the amazing volunteers who had built this campaign out of nothing, who had that kind of spirit at the heart of the grassroots movements that take place in the Democratic Party. He was trying to speak to them, to their passion, to the work they had done, and even though he'd come in third, to still kind of feel the passion, and he was speaking to them. The problem is, to the rest of the country, and with the kind of microphone he was using, he looked like he was a little bit overheated.
Well, you were talking about the importance of the new lesson of setting expectations low. Well, I'm going to play a little piece of tape of Bill Clinton after finishing second in New Hampshire in 1992.
While the evening is young, and we don't know yet what the final tally will be, I think we know enough to say with some certainty that New Hampshire tonight has made Bill Clinton the comeback kid.
How's that for an interpretation of a defeat?
I know. I mean, that's basically the opposite of the Muskie story. Is here's somebody who comes in second, and because he's had such a rough road before him with the Jennifer Flowers disclosures, the stories about draft dodging, which he doesn't answer very well at all. I had forgotten about how poorly his answer to the draft dodging accusations were. I mean, it's so Byzantine and hard to believe on its face that I can't even go into it. But the fact that he was able to, the fact that he even got any votes at all was amazing in his telling of it. And that really, I mean, you know, Clinton went on to win the nomination. But that's a perfect example of a politician knowing how to spin the expectations of the moment. And it's amazing that I can't think about it today, that a candidate would give themselves a nickname and then have it just carried along by everyone else.
We have 2 months to go before the November election. When a future whistle-stop book is written, what do you think will be the best story of 2016?
Well, I think, you know, best is a great question. I think there are moments, if I had to, you know, put the narrative together the way I do for the did for the book and do for the podcast, is I think the opening is still, the opening of the episode would have to be Donald Trump on the escalator at his building. I mean, just as a kind of, we'd never seen anything like it before. People ridiculed it. It's an event that is encased in the Trump aura, and literally encased in his building with his name on it, which is obviously a huge part of his campaign or the campaign that would grow out of that. And he gets at the bottom of the escalator and says what he did about Mexicans, which would be, for good or ill, at the center of his campaign going forward. But I think then, you know, other turning point moments, clearly his attack on the Khan family and the campaign reorganization that led to, is either going to be the turning point where he could no longer repair his campaign, or the one where he put a new team together, did some made some cosmetic changes, and went on to victory. So I think that, for the moment, is a hinge point. But there have been so many twists and turns in this campaign with 2 months to go. We may be in for a few more.
You can't make this stuff up, can you?
That's true, Ken.
John Dickerson is the host of Face the Nation and the political director at CBS News. He's the author of the new book, Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. You can find out more about the book at whistlestopbook.com. John, it was so much fun having you on the program.
Oh, for me too, Ken. Thank you so much.
Made up my mind, make a new start.
We're out of California!
With an aching in my heart.
Finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming for dead in
Ohio!
Gotta get down.
Even today, I want to be a part of it.
New York! New York!
These vagabond shoes.
Keep on rockin' me, baby. All the way from Phoenix,
Arizona,
all the way to
Dakota, Pennsylvania, Ohio, D.C.,
Northern
California,
where the girls are warm so I could be with my sweet baby.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.